Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. I believe it was Chicago who originally said, "Does anybody really know what time it is?" Today's episode is a story about how we all agreed that we would know what time it is in any given place. And it's a weird story, to be honest. Hi, I'm Ben.
Hi, I'm Noel. And I believe it was the Quad City DJs that said, "Come on, ride it. The train. Choo-choo."
There we go.
So today we're doing an episode where we're fusing the concept of time with the history of the railroads.
There we go. I like the elongation right there. That's perfect. And as we get this train rolling, let's give a big shout out to our own conductor of the locomotive that is Ridiculous History, super producer Casey Pegram. Casey, I almost want you to change the sound cue to like a train whistle.
Yeah, it should be like a Quad City DJ sample, except we'd probably get flagged for it. But yeah, just a little traditional choo-choo. Train?
were you into trains as a lad, Casey? Were you fascinated by trains?
Yeah, I had the train set. I had the tracks where you could design like elaborate death traps for the engine and so on.
Wait a minute. You weren't like one of those like arch villains that tied a damsel in distress to the train tracks, were you?
I invented the trolley problem without knowing, really the history about it.
So you bought the Lionel train set that came with a waxed mustache.
Exactly. Yes. And some rope and a damsel in distress and all that good stuff.
You know, it's funny that we're talking about trains today because just recently, so we're recording this on August 17th. And just recently, I got very, very close to getting a fare on Amtrak. Because they had a buy one, get one free sale. And I wish I got the timing right because I've always wanted to travel on Amtrak. Have you guys ever traveled by rail anywhere?
Yeah, I took a line from LA to San Francisco once. And then I pretty recently took an Amtrak from Boston to New York City. And it's crazy because it like takes longer than a flight. By quite a lot, but then you realize you can get directly on the train, you know, in at the station, which is like, you know, minutes from where I was in Boston, and then you get right off and you're at like Grand Central or Penn or whatever, and then you're just right there in the city, as opposed to ending up at LaGuardia or JFK and then having to like wait for a cab and then, you know, brave horrible New York traffic going into the city, which can take like over an hour in and of itself. So it actually kind of was a zero-sum game. But much more pleasant.
Oh, yeah. Plus, you don't have to go through, like, airport security.
Yeah. And,
I mean, by the time you factor in all the time, usually trains are, you know, within reason, they're a lot faster because you're right there in the city center after it's over.
Ding, ding, ding. I love what you said there, Casey. Once you factor in the time. That's our episode today. Trains and time, right? First off, Noel, congratulations. I had no idea. I knew you were traveling a lot to New York, but I didn't know that you were able to take the Boston to New York line. I'm curious, like, how long did it take? How did you put it together? When we were going to go on tour for another show we do, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, we actually spent a lot of time persuading our management that we wanted to travel by train. We weren't able to do it with the schedule, though. So how did you put the Boston-New York thing together?
I was traveling with a coworker who, like, lives in Boston and like takes it to New York very frequently. I can't remember the name of the line. It's like there's a name for it. It was nice. I mean, there's like a dining car and a quiet car and all that stuff. And the views are nice. You go through Stamford and, you know, Connecticut and like the countryside, and it's really picturesque and cool. But it was crazy because our ticket was at a very specific time, because you can't just, it's not like a subway. You buy a ticket for a certain time. And we were super late, really cut it close, literally hopped onto the train and then it started moving. It was very stressful. But the thing that's so cool about riding the trains is there's a lot of fun little antiquated things they do. Like someone, they don't check your ticket when you get on. They wait till it's in motion. And they check your ticket and then they put a little piece of paper on the back of your seat that indicates when you're supposed to get off. Because you only, your ticket fare, your fare price is determined by how far you're going. So if you're getting off at Stamford, your ticket's cheaper than if you're going all the way to New York City. And so they literally write a little thing and stick it in this little holder that's on the back of your seat so that they know if you're staying on longer than you're supposed to, and they will make you get off. And I saw a situation where somebody hadn't bought a ticket and they thought they could buy it on the, it was an older couple and they thought they would be able to buy it on the train and they didn't realize it sells out and they made them get off. No, it was only one member of the party. That was even the worst part. It was one person didn't have a ticket and they had to get off and the rest of them continued on. It was really sad. But yeah, man, it's interesting because like the history of the railroad is so entrenched within the history of like the country. And that technology really pushed so many things forward out of necessity. Because if you think about time, initially or, you know, for forever, time was very, very relative. Before, you know, even clocks were a thing, people would gauge time by the movement of the sun, where it was in the sky. There wasn't like a codified numerical system for what time it was like in the Middle Ages, I don't believe. But then you had like the invention of like watches and, you know, it became obviously clocks came first, but then watches, pocket watches, they were able to refine the processes and the gears and the springs and make them much more compact. But even still, it might be 5:15 in Washington, D.C. And then in like, you know, let's say Baltimore, Maryland, it would be like 5:25. And it was because it was all based on like this local time, which was also kind of a point of pride and a thing that folks didn't want to give up when the push toward standardization became a thing. It was like, no, we have the right, the sovereign right to decide what time it is here in our city.
Yeah, yeah. You know, people were saying, we don't care what Big Watch thinks. We know what time it is in Poughkeepsie, and that's the time it's going to stay. In the days before time zones, most towns would set their clocks to noon when they saw the sun reach its zenith in the sky each day. And so it was common for the time in one town to be different from the time in a town not too far away, just as you mentioned. And we know that there are many philosophers who have considered the concept of time as a social construct. We know that there are physicists and other scientists who have delved into the mystery of the thing that we call time. But when we ask ourselves about the origin of time zones, aka the reason that it's 3 hours earlier on the West Coast than it is on the East Coast, we find a very clear-cut answer. Time zones were created by railroad officials. They all got together in a series of meetings in 1883 because they were dealing with a huge problem. You see, trains are much faster than horses. They're much faster than people walking or running, which means a train leaving at, say, 10:07 in one town needs to know what time it actually is when they get to their next stop. And because there was no uniform agreement about how people should treat time, it was impossible for the railroads to know what time it was depending on their location. The U.S. just, it didn't have a time stamp, right?
And this was more than just a minor inconvenience or a scheduling, you know, snafu. This actually led to like loss of life in the form of collisions, because you know, when trains are traveling on the same track, you gotta sync them up so that they don't hit each other. And if there was a disparity in time from one station to the next or what have you, it would be a real problem. And they actually, there was a period where they would have surgeons, you know, like hired by the railway companies to travel on each route in case a collision occurred and people were injured, because it was common enough of a thing that that happened. You'd think they would have been more likely to figure out how to solve this time issue than they would just have like surgeons standing by, you know, to sew back on people's like severed limbs. I don't know. It might not have been that bad, but it certainly seemed like a problem that needed to be dealt with lickety split.
Yeah, exactly. And this was a problem that was brewing for a long time. Oh, gosh, it's going to be tough to use the word time in this episode, but we'll power through. We'll keep the train rolling. When we say that train companies and railroads are responsible for what we call time zones today, we're talking about a specific instance of a larger phenomenon, which is the effect of the economy on the concept of time. The age of exploration and then later the Industrial Revolution fundamentally changed the way the human species measures, understands, and talks about time. There's a really great article in The Atlantic by Derek Thompson from 2016 that goes into some of the things about time and the way we talk about time that we don't often think about, right? Like the idea of the weekend, not the artist, no ding on you if you're listening The Weekend, but you know, the 2 days in between those 5 day stints for many workers. The word weekend comes to us from the Industrial Revolution. Because if you think about it, before the Industrial Revolution, it didn't really make a ton of sense to think about things in terms of a Monday through Friday work week. If you worked on a farm or you were involved in agriculture, the crops didn't care that you wanted Saturday off. You had to move with the weather, move with the seasons, move with the land. And the concept of retirement is pretty old. It dates back to army service in the 1600s, but it became mainstream again when we as a species moved toward an industrial economy. It's nuts, man. I think a lot of us don't consider just how intimately tied the economy is to the concept of time.
Yeah, even the concept of happy hour is something that wasn't a thing until the 1950s. And a lot of it was kind of stuff to make, you know, your workaday Joes and Janes kind of feel a little bit better about their life. So the idea of happy hour was this kind of respite, you know, where you could like kick your feet up and get half off cocktails at your local pub and then go back to, you know, being a drone. But this absolutely went hand in hand with these new labor laws that were brought about by the Industrial Revolution. And that completely changed the way people thought about things like time. The idea of punching in, you know, punching a clock, timestamps, all of these things were not in the lexicon until this shift.
As we said, the rise in the Industrial Revolution brought about much more efficient transportation, and all of a sudden, it mattered that there was a discrepancy between the time in New York and the time in, say, D.C. In the New York Times, on April 19th, 1883, this problem reached the front page of the newspaper when they calculated that no less than, quote, 56 standards of time are now employed by various railroads of the country in preparing their schedules of running times. So if you think the few time zones we have in North America now are kind of difficult, boy, imagine having 56 different times you have to consider for the same train line.
Insane. Absolute bedlam. And, you know, I may have kind of jumped the gun a little bit earlier in talking about the real problems that were caused by not having standard time. And that was more than just, you know, being early or being late because the time in D.C. wasn't the same as the local time in New York. It is really fascinating, by the way. It was just, like you said, Ben, a few minutes different. But when you start to factor in all of these different local times, it really became a problem, even if, like, you know, just a few of them being slightly off didn't seem like that big a deal. deal. And this absolutely caused some logistical nightmares beyond just in mild inconvenience. It was actually something that led to a number of particularly nasty train wrecks. In 1849, there's a fabulous article, by the way, on Harvard about America's first time zone that you hit me to, Ben, that describes this situation in New England, where this was absolutely kind of mounting to be something truly, truly deadly. There were just more and more frequent train wrecks that were happening. People were being killed. The public was freaked out. It was really a bad look for what should have been a very exciting, you know, kind of future technology that was obviously benefiting people in many positive ways, but something was there was like a disconnect here. There were just too many time standards. Even within Boston area, you had Boston time, you had Worcester time, you had Springfield time. Every little town and burg and hamlet had their own local time. The conductors would have to change the times of their clocks, of those pocket watches. And it would be something that would just so easily go awry if it wasn't paid perfect attention to. There were even individuals that would go around and check the conductor's clocks and like fine them or sanction them in some way if their clocks weren't set correctly. So just a real brewing kind of nightmare situation that was on the horizon. And something needed to be done. The railroads collectively decided that they needed to, at the very least, without getting rid of these local times, have something called railroad time.
Yeah, this was a huge problem. Before we get really morbid, I want to point out that for some reason, in our research for this, Worcester time became stuck in my head as like a weird tagline, maybe something from like a commercial for a snack. You know, a bunch of kids are running at a refrigerator, kind of like the Sunny D commercial. But then someone's like, oh, it's Worcester time. And then there's, you know, I don't know, cheesy commercial music. Casey, you're like the emperor of sound cues. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And you are right, Noel. This was a huge problem. As more and more trains were being built and more trains were running more and more frequently, train wrecks became common. Between 1831 and 1853 alone, there were 97 different train accidents, train wrecks. And railroad time became mandated along the tracks of Boston. And from that point, the synchronization of time began to proliferate and spread because everybody was tired. Everybody who needed to work with the train system was exhausted from keeping track of both their local time and the weird, somewhat independent railroad time. So towns just started to give up their local time because it was easier to work with a more widely accepted system. According to Peter Gallison, who is a Pellegrino University professor and faculty director at Harvard's Collection of Historical Scientific Instruments, which I would love to visit and check out in person one day. According to him, towns eventually started to say, you know what, we don't want 10:56 as the town time and 11 a.m. as the railroad time, so let's just lose those 4 minutes. Let's just scoot ahead. From now on, we'll use railway time, and they were actually saving lives.
It's so funny, like we mentioned a little bit earlier, how people fear and despise change. And they're like, no, you'll have to pry those 2 minutes out of my cold, dead hands, clock hands, because they, you know, that's a point of pride. It's like, this is local control. We deserve to have our own time, and no one's going to tell me otherwise. But once you start factoring in, you know, actual loss of human life, I think it did a pretty good job of making the case. But for a while, Ben, there was like some clocks had an extra minute hand on them that would be set to local time. And then the main minute hand on these conductor clocks would be set to railroad time. But so interesting that it was only a few minutes apart. And yet there was so much grumbling about standardizing this, right?
Right, right. It all goes back to one of the hard and fast rules of existence, which is two objects cannot occupy the same space at the same time, which was happening with the trains. So in the spring of 1883. The railroad tycoons, the men of import in the train system, sent their representatives and employees to a meeting of something called the General Railroad Time Convention. On April 11th, in St. Louis, Missouri, the railroad officials got down to business. They Voltroned up. They assembled their UN, their Avengers, whatever you want to call it. And they said, okay, now that we're looking at all the facts, we're comparing all our different weird local time zones and how stressed out our conductors are and our customers, we've agreed. Let's create 5 time zones throughout all of North America. Just the 5. We'll call 1 provincial, 1 eastern, 1 central, 1 mountain, and 1 Pacific. So these railroad tycoons, maybe it's unfair to call them that, these superconductors, they thought that they had reached a brilliant solution. However, the concept of standard time zones was something many people had already thought about. There were professors more than a decade earlier who had an idea about something like time zones. One guy called them time belts, which is way cooler. Like, I want a time belt.
Dude, that sounds clearly like some sort of awesome time travel implement that, you know, like from Time Cop or like a Total Recall type situation. A time belt. I love that. Is that the same basically as this whole idea of time meridians or whatever, or like these lines of demarcation?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, when you and I were talking about this before we were recording off mic, you had brought up a great point, Noel, which is that the UK was, as they would say on Community, streets ahead when it came to time zones, right?
Yes, it's true, Ben. The Brits were indeed ahead of the curve. And in 1847, they adopted, developed, accepted universally a thing called Greenwich Mean Time, which actually was sort of employed earlier than it was like completely, you know, accepted as a universal standard. In the 1700s, the fifth astronomer, Royal Neville Maskelyne, decided to take Greenwich Mean Time to a wider audience. Before that, it had been used for astronomy, for gauging the relationship between, clock time and solar time. And a gentleman named John Flamsteed came up with a formula that converted solar time to mean time, which is just an average time. And he published this set of conversion tables in the early 1670s. And then he was made the Astronomer Royal, and he moved into the new Royal Observatory in, wait for it, Greenwich. And then, like I said, it was then brought to a much larger acceptance in the early 1700s. I don't want to imply that it was adopted in the 1700s. That's not the case. It was just a common kind of accepted thing that was used more for scientific pursuits and for like navigation and things, and for the ability to calculate longitudes and latitudes from the Greenwich Meridian, which was longitude 0 degrees. So it was for less kind of day-to-day activities and much more for science and exploration and things like that. But when the railroad kicked in the UK as well, that is when they decided to use Greenwich Mean Time as the standard, as opposed to Bristol Mean Time, which was 10 minutes behind Greenwich Mean Time, or Cardiff Mean Time, which was 13 minutes behind. So they had a very similar problem to what we had in the States, but they kind of nipped it in the bud, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Worcester time. Sorry, I can't get it out of my head.
Keep it coming. Keep it coming.
In the U.S., we talked about the April meeting in 1883. The General Railroad Time Convention met again on October 11th. And during that meeting, they decided this new standard of U.S. time zones would take effect officially on Sunday, November 18th, 1883. This is a big change that you know, officially is going to affect every single household in the country. And here's how they got away with it. I don't mean to make it sound like a caper or a time heist, even though that's a cool idea. First, newspapers, media of the time warned everybody, explained to them what would happen, just so everyone knew they weren't going crazy when they woke up on November 18th and felt like they were a few minutes off. Secondly, the shift was also pretty small. It was only a matter of a few minutes for many, many people. In New York City, in the Big Apple, the clocks would just be turned back 4 minutes. And then from that moment going forward, noon in New York would happen at the same time as noon in Boston, Philadelphia, and numerous other cities in the East, like the same exact moment. This had never happened before. It was amazing. And funny story, people were trying to make money off this too, right? Jewelers started offering to set watches to the new time standard and to sell watches too. And this is really interesting. This was a private event. This is kind of like, just for an example, this is kind of like maybe all the internet search browsers deciding to create a standardized time. The government wasn't involved at first. The federal government didn't sanction this in the United States, but the Naval Observatory in Washington offered to send telegraphs of the new time signal around so that people could all synchronize their watches at once. Imagine how Byzantine and complicated this is. I don't know about you guys, but I have like several clocks I have to reset if the power goes out at my house. And then I also have like the superstition of like, I want the coffee clock to be a few minutes ahead so I can get a jump on the day.
Ah, dude, my house is an utter shit show when it comes to clock setting. I have this really cool kind of vintagey looking radio thing that has an internet connection. And every time it loses power, it resets and it like the day and date and all of that stuff is always a little bit off. And it's so annoying because you think it would just grab it back from the internet immediately when it restarts, but you have to like go to this app and it's just, it's more trouble than it's worth. But yeah, my stove clock and my microwave clock are both completely different, and I feel like my life is falling apart. You guys, I really need to sync all my stuff and get my act together.
I'm going to brag about a clock that I've had for a number of years. It is not connected to the internet. There's not an advertisement, but I have this clock radio made by a company named Emerson, and the first one I had for like almost two decades. Again, no radio connection, but if the power went out and then came back on, this thing would just reprogram itself. If you unplugged it for like a week and then plugged it back in, it would know what time it was. Growing up, this thing was like magic. I loved it so much, I bought a second one. Emerson, if you're listening, thanks. That's amazing. It's better than, it might be one of the best clocks I've ever had. But anyhow, I digress. And we're doing a podcast about time, so we want to watch the time too. You might imagine, not everyone was thrilled about switching to standard time. We think about time as a currency of sorts, right? This is something I've said probably way too often on other shows, but think about it. We pay attention. We spend time. We count the minutes. Because of this, it's not really that surprising that people would object and they would be like, hey, what are you doing with my 4 minutes?
Oh, I know.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, the concept of wasting time, it's certainly the only commodity we really and truly can never get back. I think another thing we've talked about on the shows is the whole idea of like sunken cost fallacy and like, you know, how, oh, I can't possibly walk out of this terrible movie because I've already paid the money. And so I owe it to myself to like finish watching this bad movie, but you're never going to get that time back. You've already paid for the movie. Leave. For God's sakes, do literally anything else. So time, understandably, it does have a very important kind of resonance with folks, which is another reason why I think people really fought back initially against this idea of standardizing time, even though you'd think they would see that it was really a beneficial thing to everyone. But, you know, people are particular and they like what they like. But, you know, people that use the rails and were commuters really appreciate it. But folks that didn't, that were maybe like more rural and like farmers or something, and they really didn't leave their neck of the woods too often, they kind of fought back against it, you know, and it certainly caused other layers of confusion initially as well. And there's a pretty great example from the Philadelphia Inquirer that describes why maybe folks would have been distrustful about this, especially poorer folks. On November 21st of 1883, the Inquirer described a situation where a gentleman who owed money was ordered to appear in a Boston courtroom at 9 a.m. on the previous day. And this is the takeaway that the newspaper kind of came up with. Quote, according to custom, the poor debtor is allowed 1 hour's grace. He appeared before the commissioner at 9:48 standard time. But the commissioner ruled that it was after 10 o'clock and defaulted him. The case will probably be brought before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, but at what time is the Supreme Court meeting? You see how complicated this gets.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And this is when some folks are adopting the standard time. Some folks are holding back. There's really no rhyme or reason. This really shows the need to just, you know, S or get off the P, as they say.
Rip off the Band-Aid of horology, the study of time. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's stick with the New York Times here. On June 28th, 1884, there was a piece explaining how the city of Louisville, Kentucky had given up on standard time. They just set all their clocks ahead 18 minutes to return to solar time. And this did not end well for them because the banks in Louisville adopted the railroad time standard, but other businesses did not. So throughout the entire city for a while, people had no clue when business hours actually began or ended every day. Throughout the 1800s, most businesses saw the value of moving to standard time. And by the 1890s, standard time and time zones were accepted as everyday and ordinary, even though they weren't official until the passage of the 1918 Standard Time Act. This also established daylight saving time. And that's something that was probably on the minds of a lot of our fellow listeners, especially when we're talking about losing time. I think we can all agree, it feels like you get somehow, in some weird abstract way, ripped off when the clock springs ahead an hour, and then you're kind of like saving time when it springs back. Anyhow, there's the US, right, following the lead of the UK, but time zones had yet to go global. Britain and France had already had their national time standards decades and decades earlier, but a big part of why they were able to do that is that they were just geographically smaller countries. They didn't need more than one time zone the way the US did. So when the US was able to adopt time zones in 1883, they set an example, a precedent for the rest of the world.
That's correct. In 1884, representatives from more than 24 nations met at something called the International Meridian Conference in Washington, D.C., where they decided on where these lines of demarcation would fall, all around that gold standard we talked about, the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, England, using that as the official prime meridian, or the zero point of longitude, for like the entire world. This is insane. This is like, I can't believe they were able to, like, you know, agree on all this stuff. So traveling from east from the prime meridian, you get an hour with each time zone that you pass through. If you go west, time goes backwards by an hour with each time zone. This is what we know today. So by round about the mid-20th century, most of the world was kind of settled on this particular system of international time zones. And that is 24 zones spaced out at approximately 15-degree intervals of longitude.
And there you have it. It's so strange. I didn't imagine myself being in this position, but thank you, long dead railroad tycoons. There's so much more we could talk about with time zones. They're functional, but they're weird, especially when you look at the ways different countries and different regions may treat them for one reason or another. But ironically enough, we're going to have to make time to do that another day. We so hope you enjoyed this story. We didn't even get to talk about Casey Pegram's travels as Le Bouche around the various climes of Europe. I didn't mention the Shinkansen in Japan, which is like riding in the future. But I've got to tell you, I really want to get on Amtrak one day. And Noel, I want to thank you because you've inspired me to make it a reality.
Yeah.
It sounds like a fun time.
Oh, it is a fun time. I guess things are normal-ish now, like with social distancing, and maybe they aren't booking them as heavily, where you have to, like, you know, lower capacity. But apparently, oh, by the way, this is just the last little thing to leave us with, and I'm sure this is, I hope this is the case on trains as well, but apparently the air filtration system in subway cars is, like, one of the most efficient air filtration systems around, because it doesn't, like, it the way it filters out microbes in the air is very, very effective. And so you think about sitting in a subway car and, like, oh, I'm just breathing in everybody's, you know, gook. Not the case, apparently. And I wish I could remember where I saw this, but I saw a really great infographic that showed how air is circulated. So I think it's probably a similar system on trains, on Amtrak trains. I don't know this for sure, but I would hope that we are approaching a place where that will be a reality, where we can safely do a really cool long haul train trip. And I would love to, maybe we can do it as a family, as a Ridiculous History family.
Agreed. Thanks so much to super producer Casey Pegram, to our research associate Gabe Luzier, and to Alex Williams, who made the time to compose this slap and bop you hear at the beginning and end of every episode.
It is both a slap and bop and a bop and slap, a high five slap for a job well done, Alex. I don't know where I was going with that, but I had to sew it up somehow. Huge thanks to Christopher Hasiotis, always here in spirit, like Mufasa, hovering in the sky, watching down upon us from the afterworld. Huge thanks to researcher extraordinaire Gabe Luzier, and also Jonathan Strickland, that notorious and dubious quizster, who I think we probably have not heard the last of.
Agreed. And it's a shame that he wasn't here for this episode, because I think he could do the perfect railroad villain voice.
Indeed. And also, you know, while twirling his waxed mustache, which he has, I promise.
He really does.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.